follow me down this deep, dark hole.
Welcome to New Horror Express, your fortnightly podcast chatting to the best indie talent the horror genre has to offer, as presented by the Morbidly Beautiful Network. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and on today's podcast, I'm chatting to writer Christina Delia about her multifaceted writing career, which encompasses short stories, plays, and poetry. Over the course of the interview, we talk about her poetry collection, Guts, Lips, 55 Voracious Poems. I say it like that because it has exclamation marks, so you gotta say it like that. Guts, Lips. We also talk about how she was drawn to horror, and we have an interesting conversation about trigger warnings, but you don't have to worry about it, that there's no rants about woke people. It's an interesting, constructive conversation, which I know is unusual on the internet, but it's good. You're in perfectly safe territory here. We just have a general conversation about how useful it is and when it is useful and when it might not be. That's all. Anyway, plus we get into how horror can be cathartic, why anxious people are often drawn to horror, and that old stalwart about how there was much more kid-orientated horror in the late 80s and early 90s than pretty much any other time. And we don't know why that is. It's come up several times on the podcast, presumably because a lot of people who come on the podcast seem to be around my age. Also, I should warn you that this episode was recorded in December, so there is a Christmas reference, and that's why. We're not just mental. Anyway, now on to my interview with Christina. Hi, Christina. Welcome to New Horror Express.
Hi, Scott. Thank you so much for having me.
That's no problem. It's a pleasure to have you on the show. So we have you on the show to talk about a whole bunch of things, your career. But one of the things you mentioned that you might want to talk about is your story Rain Delay that got into the magazine Planet Scum. So first of all, tell us a little bit about that.
I mean, I've been really lucky with the publications that I've been accepted to in horror, and I guess Planet Scum is more like punk rock kind of sci-fi as well, but I like these publications. Like, it's not like I've been in anything that I'm like, oh, all right, like, so I was really excited when they wanted me. And Rain Delay is kind of like my response to just the idea. Like, I grew up with Twilight Zone. I love the Twilight Zone. I also loved 80s sitcoms, you know, like Alf and Who's the Boss. And I guess it was just a bit of culture shock just with the way the world is. Something that I tend to write about a lot is addiction. Not because I'm addicted, but because I've known people who have been. And I just think it's like the scourge, the quiet kind of plague that's around here, like a quiet vampirism, if you will. People don't talk about it. It's like they turn their eyes, you know, they're, oh, it's too bad, it's sad. Same thing like with, I guess, homelessness. It's just, it becomes, you know, they're different than us. It's somebody else's problem. And we just keep not talking about it. And so one thing I always loved about the Twilight Zone and just growing up is, you know, I had seen a Rod Serling documentary from Fathom Events. And they were saying that, you know, he wanted to talk about, you know, racial injustice, inequality, fear of war and famine and things. And nobody would have let him talk about that stuff. So he put it in his horror and it compelled people. And then, you know, you kind of got to, you could connect, you know. And so I do that. And in Rain Delay, there's for sure, it's just the sadness of it. And also kind of the absurdity, not just of the aliens, but also of the humans, you know. And just how we treat each other. So And I have moments of humor. I used to, initially when I started out writing, I wrote humor, kind of more comedic light pieces. I'm a huge fan of Shirley Jackson from childhood. The first story I ever read by her was in like a Basil reader my mother had, and it was like an excerpt from one of her. It was either it was from like you know how she had Life Among the Savages and all those kind of Irma Bombeck kind of books, like housewife humor. And this was called The Sneaker Crisis, and it was one of the funniest pieces I've ever read, and still is one of the funniest pieces. And I just loved it. I laughed so hard. And then years later, I you know, read something like Louisa, Please Come Home or The Lottery. And I was just like, how is this the same woman, but it same writer really, you know, and it was, and it floored me. And I was like, wow, like that amazing duality. You're so much there. But I noticed there's always these little moments of humor in her horror stories. And there's always these little kind of dark moments in her humor, and she's brilliant. So I definitely, she was my idol, her and like Louisa May Alcott, you know, who also wrote some horror, but also wrote Little Women. I like the idea of having one foot in this world and then another foot somewhere else, you know? So.
I didn't actually know that. Like, forgive my ignorance about Louisa May Alcott. Like, I just know her as the author of Little Women. I didn't know she wrote horror as well.
She wrote, yeah, she, I don't think Little Women, to my understanding, was something that, I mean, she was, I guess, happy to write about her family, but I mean, I think that, I mean, she wrote a lot of just kind of like, I guess, more pulp kind of things like that. Mm-hmm. And maybe she wrote under, you know, maybe a pseudonym or something at that time. But yeah, she's written like about kind of witcher kind of stories, and she's written a lot of things. She's written like fairy stories for children. Yeah, she's very, very prolific.
Amazing. every day's a learning day.
Oh yeah, I went to Concord. That was where I mean, because it was like a childhood dream come true. Most kids want to go to Disneyland. I wanted to go to the Mark Twain House in Hartford, Connecticut, and Louisa May Alcott House in Concord. And I saw the house that you know, was basically where she lived and where she wrote, and it was amazing. So it was cool.
that is cool. You were saying that you wrote initially kind of humor pieces, that you're more more comedy. How did you transition in your writing from humor to horror?
I always admired horror. I always had that. I guess I never thought, and this is going to sound terrible, but I never thought I would be accepted in the horror world. Like, I honestly, one of my first big publications was for Simon & Schuster. I won this contest called Be the Next Downtown Girl, and it was this chick lit piece called You Should See the Other Girl, in this kind of chick lit New Year's Eve anthology called In One Year and Out the Other. And it's not to say it wasn't a good story, but I was not my authentic self, because I'm writing romancy kind of, you know, I was out of touch with, I had this bravery in me and this darkness in me, and a lot of times I would submit to places, and you know, more my mainstream places, and they'd be like, this isn't for us. And I remember one time they did, and I was like, I said out loud, I said, then who is it for? Because they're, you know, I find horror writing is, I've been through some dark times in life, as we all have, and I find it very therapeutic. Like, I'm not currently in, you know, traditional therapy now, I have been before, but horror writing has saved me time and again, just to be able to express myself in a cathartic way, that I can get all the demons out, I can put them on the page, and they're still mine, but they're there. And I can, you can kind of change things. You can change things that have happened in the past. You can save people, or you can, maybe you make sacrifices in the story that you wouldn't otherwise make in life. But it just is a beautiful thing. And I was very, very grateful and fortunate to, I had written a story, called Like Abigail Winchell. And I had submitted it to more like mainstream magazines, and they were like, this isn't for us. And I just, on a lark, I guess, I saw there was a call for submission from Dark Ink and this editor, Rebecca Rowland. And I remember I read her synopsis of everything that, you know, she wanted in the story. And I was like, oh, she's like, she's too cool. Like, there's no way she's going to want me. But I submitted my story and she loved it, and we connected. And I consider her so much a mentor, a dear friend. I also have a horror mentor from the Horror Writers Association, Sumiko Salson, wonderful, wonderful. And Robert Otone, just so many amazing people I've met that I guess when I was younger in my formative years, I don't know if I would have had the nerve, but it's almost like when you meet somebody, you get along with them and you connect, and then you're able to be more your true self. I was able to just kind of write more how I really want to write. It's this wonderful feeling of acceptance and it's going to be okay. But horror allows me that. I mean, a lot of people will shut down, and that is so interesting too. The conversation where people are like, oh, I don't watch horror. I don't read horror. I can't handle it. I'm like, you could though. I mean, it's digestible, and there's so many different genres, which I love. It's not all like splatterpunk. It's not all like, you know, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and that stuff is wonderful. I mean, but for the audience, some people just get kind of turned off and they think that's all it is. I mean, it's Christmas, 'tis the season. I'm going to watch the original Black Christmas because that's like one of my Christmas movies, but I'm also going to watch It's a Wonderful Life because I love that movie. And there's a lot of darkness in that movie too, you know, just like in real life. So.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I totally agree. And you can have that kind of duality as like, you know, what you say, it's Christmas, you know, I love Black Christmas. I've watched Black Christmas a lot. But I also regularly watch The Muppets Christmas Carol at Christmas.
That's, you know, awesome. Like,
it's great.
Yeah, I mean, don't you love, though, like, the idea, like, with Christmas, like, it wasn't it? They used to tell ghost stories. I wish people would rekindle that, like, the whole Charles Dickens kind of, right? Like, back then, didn't they used to, I wish they'd rekindle that, because it's, I mean, they probably do in a lot of places, just not anywhere I'm familiar with. I should probably go into the city at some point and see, but I just love that. I don't know, the duality, like you said, that I respond to that. I love the layers of human beings. I love, again, Shirley Jackson, the idea that she's so funny but and light, but she's got this darkness, and then she's so dark, and it's like she just sucker punches you with the amazing brutality, but it's also very human, and it's unfortunately, she's captured the essence a lot of times of fear and of how people can be to each other, so... I love her. She's one of my favorites.
I love how weird people are as well. Because I've had a lot of conversations like that as well, when people are like, find out I'm a horror fan. And, you know, some people are like also horror fans and be like, oh, that's cool. Like, what horror do you like? But then some people are like, oh, no, I couldn't possibly watch horror, and just don't like kind of violent things. But some people you meet are like, oh, I couldn't possibly watch horror. That's far too much for me. I, something like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. No, couldn't possibly watch that in one breath. And then in the next breath, they're like, have you seen that new 6-part Ted Bundy documentary? And I'm like, well,
yeah.
I'm like, you know, that's, I mean, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre did not happen. You know, like, I don't understand these people.
No, I completely agree with you. In fact, I think I did speak about that in one interview that I had done, because it always bothers me, like, people wear all the swag of, like, you know, I hate those, like, you know, Charlie loves you kind of, I don't know. I'm not judgmental. I try really hard not to be. I know we all can be. Yeah, I just have issue with people glorifying and romanticize real murderers who've victimized people. They haven't done anything worth their salt as human beings. You know, and yet these people that they killed were, a lot of times when I watch these documentaries or anything, they're so much more interesting than these stupid serial killers. And it's like, why are you not praising them and celebrating their lives? Like, they mattered and they fought for their lives. And that's what we're all doing every day. We are surviving, we're living. So, I mean, I love horror because it's make believe. You know, they get up after, you know, the actors are treated well. They, you know, wipe off their fake blood. They go to the craft services table and they have lunch and they go home to their families and friends and they can breathe and live and that's why I like it. It's a way to kind of exorcise demons and write demons, but I don't want to hurt anyone. And so people who think that, I mean, look, I know serial killer documentaries, they're compelling and we all want to know the truth. We all want to solve mysteries. When I was a kid, where I used to live in New York, I lived in Valley Stream, there was a very high profile murder. It was a senseless, awful murder. It was the murder of this young girl. She was 13. Her name was Kellyanne Tinyas, and she was murdered by a neighbor. And this was down the street from my house. And I think that is instrumental in me writing horror, because I remember being a little child going outside playing. All the kids were playing on the front lawn. Everything was happy. And then after this happened, this girl went missing. Everybody was speculating. It was in the news. It'd be at the King Cullen. video footage of, like, was it her father? Was it this? Was it? Nobody knew. And of course, everybody assumes, kind of like, you know, almost in like a horror story. And when they found out who it was the older brother of this neighbor. And he ended up going to prison for it. But it was just like this darkness just fell over everything. All of a sudden, people were locking their doors more. You know, kids were not playing in the front yard alone. Everything was different. And that really rattled me as a kid. We ended up moving. But it was the idea that, like, somebody could just take somebody's light out, and not just their own light, but the light of, you know, a whole town, and steal everybody's innocence. And it was senseless, you know. But that really, I've always been very interested in true crime, but not to glorify any of these people, because why? You know, it's the people that they took out who really should be here who matter, you know. So so that's always the kind of thing, like somebody saying, I saw a Ted Bundy documentary, but if they're like, yeah, he killed so many people, it's great, it's like, are you insane? Like, no, you know, it's one thing to watch it and be interested in humanity and understand, but I genuinely don't want to ever hurt anyone, which was something that came up with some of the writers I knew, because I don't know how you feel about this with the trigger warnings in horror, where people are like, we need a trigger warning. It's like, if it helps somebody, okay. But like, I personally don't want it. Like, horror is going to trigger me. Like, as a horror fan, sometimes I want to be triggered. I want to go beyond my own fear and see what's there. You know, like I can't speak for everyone, you know, but I just know some people said there was a story that I wrote called Moi Aussi, and a beautiful anthology called Unburied. And it was a collection of queer dark fiction. And it just, people were really saying, like, you know, we were triggering people. I mean, just the fact alone, you know, is we have all these writers, a lot of queer writers, you know, I myself am bisexual, I'm proudly so. And I just, to be able to, I don't know, like, be in this beautiful book with all of these amazing writers, and then have people kind of just kind of like, oh yeah, no, you triggered us. It's like, we worked really hard and we put our souls into it, and we did not intend to trigger or hurt anyone. Quite the contrary. It's about healing. I think horror is very healing. So I know it's all how you look at it. And my attitude with somebody saying something triggers them is like, maybe don't read the book then. I had done an interview where I talked about It. It is, my friends all love It, and I can't do it. I tried with the Tim Curry It. I've seen the pictures of, you know, the new Pennywise, the newer one. I can't do it. I've seen clips, and I'm like, oh my gosh. Because as a kid, that was one of my bookmobile books we took out of the bookmobile, the traveling library. And I remember reading it, and I got to, I won't give anything away, but very early on, that plot point where something happens, and I was like floored, and I threw the book. It was a library book, and I threw it at the wall. I said, no, I threw it. But I love Stephen King. And I'm just saying, I haven't been able to get past that. But I, you know, then I don't read it. I know people love it. I know people connect with it. I, you know, I don't have any issue with that. I just, me personally, if it triggers me and I don't want to read it, I don't have to. Same thing with like a Rob Zombie movie. You know, I like The Lords of Salem. But some of the other ones are, you know, they're heavy with a lot of sexual violence. I myself, it's not my thing. But do I think I should go to, you know, picket Rob Zombie and say, you shouldn't make this art, you're triggering me? Do I have the right to do that? You know, he has his audience, he has his own vision. You know, that's what I'm saying. Like, I'm very live and let live, but at the same time, I think we all have to be respectful of each other, which...
I mean, I get it. Like, I don't know. I mean, I think it can be useful in terms of, like, finding things up. I mean, obviously, they, like, do it on, like... television, you know, if you watch something on television, it'll say, you know, like, this contains sexual violence, scenes of domestic abuse, you know, drug use, whatever, and you know, like whatever it is, and you know, if you're not into that, you know that not to watch that. I mean, so it could, you know, like I'm, you know, I mean, obviously. Horror can be triggering in some ways, but like can be triggering in a kind of cathartic sense, but
yeah.
Also like I think people generally kind of know their limits, and you know, so if they are particularly jarred by for example sexual violence, then they you know, and they know that that's something that's going to be coming up. They'll know that, you know, like, it's probably not for them.
Yes, I agree. I think it also, yeah, I think I could handle the trigger warning thing better if people weren't coming at each other about it. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, you have something like this anthology, Unburied. Like, my story was very personal and it's about abuse. So people coming at it saying, you know, you triggered me. It's like, but you know, I was brave to write it, right? So there's that balance of like, we can have the conversation like you and I are doing now. But do we have to, you know, come at people with a place of anger? And I know that's hard with the pandemic. Everybody's, you know, I mean, I everybody that I know that's a writer, they're so open. Like, they're open to possibility. They're open to communicate. You know, it's just, you know, when people come at each other, it's just like, I always feel bad for some of my writer friends when somebody comes down on them. I'm like, they are not the person you should come down on. They're kind, you know, so. But I guess people, you know, everybody kind of has their experiences, and we are the sum of all of our experiences.
Yeah, that's true. And I think it can be hard sometimes. I think when people are in a state of being triggered by something, that they might respond in a very violent way that, that they might regret later. Like, because they're in that kind of mode of, so the attack, but maybe they regret that. I mean some people are just going to attack people to attack people, you know, as you see in social media and stuff. But you know, like, I like to believe that a lot of, you know, that most people, the majority of people are essentially good, and sometimes they just make kind of bad decisions based on like because a certain stressor has affected them in a certain way, and that chemistry has created a bad reaction. You know what I mean?
No, I absolutely do. And I will tell you something, that kind of thinking that what you just said is the kind of thing that people, like, we all need, like the idea that, you know, it's like looking at something from a different approach and the respect and the communication. Like, I feel, you know, maybe you can save the world, Scott, because honestly, like, I would hope so. And it's funny because everybody, like, you're a horror fan, like, you know, and a writer as well, and yet you get it completely, and that's what's in here. It's like the idea of our humanity. That's what horror is to me. The battle against the idea of good and evil. Well, what is good? What does good look like? And just because good looks good, is it good? Or, you know, what's lurking underneath the surface? We all want to see what's simmering, you know, and that's why we love it as fans, as writers. It's just, I am just my authentic self when I write horror. It was such a joy to be able to embrace that part of myself that I always thought, like, oh, but I'm not, like, you know, bloody enough, and I'm not, like, you know, like, but yet, you know, sometimes it can be kind of bloody, but my horror tends to be more psychological, and, you know, the things in our head are always so terrifying, you know, and the idea of acceptance and who can you trust, like, the world we live in is, you know, enough material for sure, but there's a piece when you're able to just get that out on the paper. And most horror writers I've known are pretty cheerful people, and I think it's because we're able to just get it out in a cathartic way.
Yeah. Because, like, I've often find that people working in horror, you know, I talk to a lot of people both from the film world and the literary world, and people working in horror often are kind of not the people that I think people from the outside of horror kind of expect, you know, like, kind of these dark, brooding people who are, you know, like, you know, thinking evil thoughts or something, you know, like, I don't know, like, I think there's a particular image of in people's imaginations about the kind of people who make horror, and often you know, like, they're just people who are nice people, and often, you know, because it's something that has come up on the podcast a lot, you know, like, it is the catharsis thing, you know, like, they're attracted to it because of, you know, it explores certain psychological things, and it gives them a kind of safe space to explore those kind of psychological things. And, you know, often, I mean, I am a person who has experienced a lot of depression and anxiety in my life, and often I talk to other people in the podcast, and you know, anxiety has been talked about a lot on this, way more than I thought when I started the podcast, you know, amongst kind of horror creators.
Yeah, and I think because, and I agree with you completely, I think because, and I too have dealt with my share with anxiety for sure, and yet it does something when you get it on the page. It's like, it's almost like a connection of like, I understand this world I'm creating, and I'm going to put all this, I channel it into it. And it just, it kind of almost leaves my body a little bit, you know, until the next story. It just, it's like there's a buildup, there's a release, and it comes out and it comes on the page, and you just feel so good. Like, I said what I needed to say, and I said it to the world, but I said it to myself, and I'm healing. Like, I feel it. I really believe horror just really heals people. And that's why anytime people tell me like, oh no, not horror. And I'm like, oh, okay. I'm sorry if you look at it that way, but to me, it has saved me in so many ways.
I mean, just as a horror consumer of viewer, reader, you know, like, I kind of feel the same way, you know, because yeah, it's an easy, I think it allows, there's a lot of breadth in horror, and it's an easier pill to swallow. If, you know, if you're reading kind of non-fiction writing on anxiety or addiction or abuse, you know, not that I've suffered any abuse, but I'm just saying, using that as an example, or, you know, like, you know, horror is like an easier conduit because it can still be an entertaining story while exploring those themes. Whereas if it can be overly heavy, you know, reading something that's a kind of straight literary fiction version of that, or like a non-fiction version of those stories.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just, I mean, I loved as a little kid, even though I was afraid a lot, like even with fairy tales and things. And I would say my first horror movie was Bambi, which I think I read Stephen King said the same thing was his first horror movie. I was like, yeah, because I didn't see that coming, you know, like I was in the theater with my mom, and they'll still tell the story where I like flipped out. And I was like, how could you take me to see this? I used to shut down so much with the things I was afraid of as a child. Like, my mother would have to, she read me, I remember, Hansel and Gretel. And my big focus on it was like, they said something about this witch used to eat children, you know? And I said, well, what about those children? And my mom was like, well, Hansel and Gretel were fine at the end. And I said, no, what about the other children that the witch captured and ate? And I kept thinking about these imaginary children. It just bothered me. So my mom would read it to me again, and she'd be like, and the witch was never able to catch any children, and she didn't eat any children, and she was always hungry because she didn't eat any children. And but that was the kind of kid I was so anxious. I needed to just know things were okay. But I guess just it's interesting. It's like how you channel stuff. Like, I had read about Henry Rollins, and he channels his anger into his music and into his, you know, his spoken word performances. And it's like, you know, it doesn't have to be a weakness. You know, my anxiety, my personal anxiety, and that of a lot of horror writers and artists, doesn't have to be a weakness. We can channel this into our art, and thus making it a strength. So, I mean, it's so valuable to me that, you know, I'm able to have the outlet. And I think about a lot of people who don't have an outlet like that. And I think people should have, you know, I love the arts, and it saves people time and again. I feel like, just from being a patron of the arts, somebody who, you know, listens to music or reads books or watches a movie and connects, but also for the creators too. Like, we're all saving ourselves, we're saving each other, and I think it's a beautiful thing.
So, kind of coming back to your work, I know that you've been working on a poetry collection that you plan to self-publish.
Yes.
Called Guts, Lips, 55 Voracious Poems.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, okay. I had a friend who had passed away, and she never got to finish a project she was working on, and it didn't sit right with me. And ever since the first kind of writing I ever did as a child was poetry, and I loved poetry. Growing up, my favorites were Langston Hughes, Sylvia Plath, Maya Angelou, and I still love them. I mean, incredible, just the connection. But I I went through, I had stopped writing poetry for sure when I was younger. And I went, I mean, I'd say by college, I wasn't really, senior year, I had a poetry class and that was it. I wasn't writing after that. But I did publish maybe like two poems, little ones, you know, but I never focused on it. And I ended up getting, I got divorced. And then during the pandemic, I got diagnosed with an autoimmune disease, ulcerative colitis. And I didn't see that coming. But it kind of like made sense because I used to go to the doctors all the time when I went and they'd say, oh, you know, this feels a little weird. This is weird. And they're like, oh, you're just a little bit of a, you know, nervous Nelly or something. But then when I figured out that I had ulcerative colitis, it was like all the things that were weird ailments like clicked. And it was like, oh, that's why this happens. Oh, okay. That's why when I eat a salad, it hurts. Like, that's weird. Like, people don't have that problem, but it does, you know? So strange things. And when I found out I had ulcerative colitis because I had a flare, and I would not wish this pain on my worst enemy. I've never experienced, because people are like, oh, how do you know? I'm like, oh, you know, like you would, I'm not going to be graphic, you know, because I know this is a horror podcast, but there's certain kinds of horror we don't want to, but you just, you know, it was pain, it was blood, it was awful. And I was doubling over. And then when we figured out what it was, you know, I was very lucky that my medicine worked. And, but in that time when I was diagnosed and I was just not sure what the heck this was. And I was trying to, you know, muddle through, I just could only write poems. Every time I, you know, set to write anything else, it was just, I couldn't even getting like, you know, rejection is part of writing, but getting rejection letters, even the form ones, physically hurt me. I felt like, because my body was rejecting me, like it felt like the world was rejecting me. So I was like, let me just focus on what I feel like physically doing. And I wrote these poems, and I was really happy that I did it. I'm surprised that I did it. I don't think I would have sat there and physically written this kind of, you know, poetry, except I guess just it was almost just like a to channel all this pain in this physical. So I did that, and that's why it's called Guts Lips, because it's poems about my body, my ever-changing body. Like I had a child, I have a beautiful daughter, and I'm so fortunate. And you know, I have ulcerative colitis now, and it, you know, I don't plan to have any more kids. So in a way, the book was kind of like a baby to have. I was able to birth something, you know, astounding to me. And I'm grateful that I did. But I have to put it out. I'm hoping to put it out soon, and I'm pleased with it. And the thing with the arts is, I guess it's about, for me, I can put it out there. I genuinely hope somebody likes it, but if they don't, I like it. I said what I needed to say, and that felt really good.
And was it, I mean, you know, I mean, 55 poems does seem like a lot of poems, but was there ones that you wrote that didn't end up in the collection, or like you had to kind of sift through and choose?
No. Basically what happened was, it's almost like I wrote it in real time. Everything in there is how I wrote it, just put together. Like there's nothing I edited or own. It's almost like when you take sometimes I take the selfie on Instagram and I'll say like, you know, no makeup, you know, no filter. This was like no filter. So yeah. Warts and all, you know, but yet beautiful because it was real.
And I was wondering about the title as well. I mean, you explained the kind of background of the title, but I was wondering in the terms of like it's stylized with exclamation points. I was wondering like why you decided to do that particular thing.
I'm weird with exclamation points. I'm in love with them. And I remember I read an F. Scott Fitzgerald quote where he was saying like, you know, how they're unnecessary. I'm paraphrasing, but you know, it was not pro exclamation point. And yet, I love it. That's how I talk. Like I exclaim a lot. I get excited. I'm out with my friend. Oh, wow. I know this song, you know, something like that, you know? So I just felt like it was the best when I write it. That's how I talk. And my guts, I needed an exclamation point. My guts felt like they were overtaking my body, but also it was gutsy of me to do this, like, you know, for myself. I'd never written a poetry book before. I'm thinking if people were self-publishing years ago, like in the 90s when I was a teenager, I know they made zines and stuff, which was also kind of like the aesthetic there too. I also kind of wanted it to be like the whole like live nude girls or something, you know, like just like an exclamation look at this, because I want it to be known, the things that I wrote about. I wrote about a lot of things. I wrote about the female body, pregnancy, heartbreak, IUDs. I mean, I wrote about my physical body betraying me with this autoimmune disease that I never saw coming. For all the anxiety I've ever had in my life, I was actually at peace when they told me I had this because I was like, oh, that makes sense. The things we fear that are going to come and get us are not the things that are going to be presented to us sometimes. It's going to be something that never crossed your mind. I used to watch these, you know, you watch the drug commercial and it's like actor portrayal. And there's a dude with ulcerative colitis and it says he just like grimaces and grabs his stomach or something. And then, you know, he's walking in a field with flowers with somebody and he's smiling or he's at a dinner party and it's like everything's fine. He's on, you know, pharmaceutical, big pharma, yay. But like, but that's, you know, that was my picture of an autoimmune disease. I had no idea. People live with a lot of different stuff. And while I'm very lucky that mine is, you know, with, I can deal with it with medicine. It's different. My body, I have a different relationship with my body now because, you know, it does make you tired. It does make you feel different, you know, bloated sometimes. I can't eat this. I can't eat that. And there's this fear that like, it could get worse. And I tried not to think about that. You know, my doctor said my medicine could work forever or it couldn't. And I know people who go through a heck of a lot worse. I mean, it's no picnic, but it's the reality of like, people do have things to deal with. And I wanted to, years ago when I was getting divorced, I would had gone to church and there's a priest there, a Monsignor, his name was Monsignor Joe. And I was telling him, you know, I was crying. And he said to me, you have to find the gift in the bad situation because there's always a gift. And the gift for me, I think, was I was able to write poetry again, which made me feel very free and alive and connected. And so that's why I wrote the book. I wanted to feel that way again that I used to feel when I was younger. And I didn't want my body to just become this thing that has an autoimmune disease and I drag around. You know, I feel like a big bag of bones. I wanted it to be mine and free in the ways that I want it to be free.
And I must say, like, I can absolutely... sympathize with you because like I've never had anything as bad as what you have, but I've had like IBS-C since I was 16, so I know.
So you get it, yeah.
Pains in the gut it's not a picnic. It's not.
It's certainly not. Yeah, and yet it's hard to for other people to understand. You know, my daughter has a lot of food allergies. She has life-threatening food allergies. I always have people say to me, oh, you know, I am lactose intolerant. I'm like, but listen, she's allergic to the protein. If she eats the food, she'll die. It's not, you know, she's allergic to cheese. She's allergic to nuts. She's allergic to egg. I mean, you go on and on. There's like 12 things she's allergic to. But my point is, you know, she's the happiest kid. She's the sweetest kid. And I'm so lucky. Because I look at her and she's even told me, she's like, mom, you know, I can live with this. She's like, you're going to get through your ulcerative colitis. And it's like, you know, wow. Like, you know, can your kid be your hero? Because she really is. Like, she's just strong and sweet. And I aspire to be like her when I don't feel like her, you know, when I feel like grouchy or like, you know, and that was another thing that priest had told me. He said, you know, she's really here to be your teacher. I was like, that's interesting. I'm not really a religious person. I think I'm a spiritual enough person. I'm a compassionate person, but I've learned a lot, you know, finding the gift in the bad situation. My daughter being my teacher, just, you know, I've opened up to possibility and just the way the world is and life. And life is really beautiful. There's the sad, dark, horrifying parts. And we capture that as horror writers, but there's a lot of beauty, and if we're lucky, there's some peace, too.
I was going to ask as well, one of your other, you briefly mentioned it, but, like, one of your other kind of excitements of the year is you became an affiliate member of the Horror Writers Association, and I know you were excited about that, so tell us how that happened.
I applied and I didn't know. I thought I needed a few more credentials, but I was waiting. And then as it turned out, I you know, there's a whole packet. I mean, you can apply and be a member even if you aren't a writer, or, you know, there are librarians who are members. There's all kinds of membership. They're very supportive, inclusive organization. But I wanted to be.
That. I thought you would have to be like a writer of some sort.
No, to be an affiliate member, you have to have a certain amount of publications. To be an active member, you have to have a lot more, you know. And some people want to wait until they're an active member. But I would say anybody who wants to join them, look into the Horror Writers Association because they're cool people. And you know, it's just, it's nice to have this sense of community, especially when you're, you know, as a writer, at least for me, I've often feel displaced or as an outsider. And it's actually, I had read an article a while back, they were saying that the scourge of our generation is loneliness because people are okay now saying, hey, I'm depressed, but people are embarrassed to say that they're lonely. And that really struck me that there's a lot of adults who, you know, don't necessarily have the friendships or the support and they're just kind of muddling through and you know, but in this way, I mean, every single person I've met in the Horror Writers Association, they are not just kind, but generous with their time. They are, you know, I have a wonderful mentor, Sumiko Salson, who's just cool and brilliant and generous. Like they will talk to you, you know, Rebecca Rowland, like I said, Robert O'Toole, so many people that just reach out and care. Like they genuinely care and they want you to do better. It's like nobody's competing. I always feel like I'm competing with myself, like from the past, you know what I mean? Like, okay, I don't want to write this anymore. I want to write this, but people are always like, oh, if you want to get ahead, why are all these writers friends with writers? It's like, we want that nurturing feeling. Like, look at somebody like, you know, H.P. Lovecraft and he supported other writers and he, you know, he was friends. I think he spent a lot of time writing letters to his writer friends. I know Shirley Jackson spent a lot of time writing letters. There's something about that connection. You know, we have that now with the internet. We're able to, you and I right now, we're able to talk and we're writers and we're artists and we're able to communicate in such a lovely way that, you know, I go walk around where I live. A lot of times people look at me like I have 10 heads. I mean, I do dress a little bit alternative, but I don't fit in and I'm used to being an outsider. I went to college in Philly. I was not an outsider there. Everybody was, you know, cool art school, went to the University of the Arts and it's a great education. Just for life, just knowing people and seeing all different kinds of people and just feeling, you know, this is cool, this is art. But here, you know, where I'm at, pretty suburban. Everybody's lovely. They're very nice. But, you know, I'm a divorced, you know, mom, you know, single mom. I dress a little, you know, I got my spikes and I wear all black and I'm happiest this way. But, you know, I don't really always fit in. I'm a little bit like, you know, in the Munsters. when the, you know, the neighbors come to visit and then they run out of the house. But I'm kind of people. I just I want to be accepted for who I am, just like everyone else does.
Yeah, I think, I mean, yeah, I think people can be kind of like you say, like judgmental like that, you know. I mean, like I rock up most places in jeans and a metal t-shirt, you know, and yes. You know, people might
Well, that's awesome.
Like look at me and my long hair and my beard and you know, like it'd be like, I don't know about this guy. But
and yet yeah. You're a kind person and you clearly would help anybody and talk to anybody, and yet yeah, and that's one thing I took from the Twilight Zone as a child. That was one thing that left a lasting impression on me, is like, you know, just what the public opinion of what is socially appropriate is not necessarily, you know, I mean, a lot of times, you know, the monsters aren't due on Maple Street, you know, we're the monsters, we're the ones who, you know, like in the lottery or something, Shirley Jackson, we're the ones who come at each other and from fear, from a place of fear. But if we lead from a place of love and just compassion and genuine respect for each other, I don't think it has to be like the darkness that has to always fall, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I love the, you know, like, you know, things that make you think like that, you know, that like, you know, it's all about your perspective on things. You know, it's a bit like the, you know, the book I Am Legend, you know, where it's like
Richard Matheson.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, where the guy, you know, is fighting all these monsters. But then, you know, at the end of the story, which the movie fucks up, like, you know, you realize that the monsters see him as a monster. He is, you know, like, he's the psychopath killing all of them. And they, you know, like, so yeah, it's all about that perspective of like, yeah, who really is the monster, you know?
Yeah. And in these panicked times, like, you know, it's just like to me in the Twilight Zone, it's like people panic and they run around because everybody's, you know, oh no, you know, this variant, this thing. And I get it. And I want to be as protected as possible, but you know, we can't turn on each other as human beings, you know? And I noticed when I was a kid, I don't remember people attacking everybody politically. I think everybody had their own opinions, you know, and maybe we didn't agree with it, but I feel like sometimes you talk to people every day is like Thanksgiving with an angry uncle. It's like, I'm not interested in hearing, I have my own opinions, and yes, you know, I can learn and change my mind. That's kind of like what they teach us in college, right? Like, you know, you're supposed to evolve as a human being, but at the same time, like, I don't want to go on social media and have people scream at me over politics that I don't want to engage in that. I'd rather go on social media and say happy birthday or, oh, hey, haven't seen you in a while or nice cat, you know, like I don't want to fight all the time. I want to just live peacefully.
Yeah. But then, I mean, it's hard to know sometimes what reality is.
Yes.
Because it's like, I remember reading an article on the BBC website, you know, like where it was like you know, talking about like social media and like people being like woke or like anti-woke or, you know, this and that, you know, whatever. But then it was like a survey basically of like people on the street, and like what the survey proved is like 2/3 of people didn't know what the hell the term woke meant, you know. So it's like social media is like this antechamber where you're like, where you can kind of believe that these conversations are going on everywhere in the real world. Like the thing, like, I don't know if you were aware of like the controversy around the Star Wars movie, The Last Jedi, where people were like, some people were praising it and some people were like, oh, this is terrible. This is like the feminization of Star Wars. It's, you know, the agenda, this blah, 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 blah. These people are idiots. But anyway, you know, and it was this big controversy, and it was the same with the female Ghostbusters remake or whatever. People got like excited about it. But the thing is, like, these conversations aren't happening in the real world as much as, like, most people that are like, oh, right, there was a female Ghostbusters? I didn't know. You know, like, or like, oh, people were angry about that? I didn't know. You know, like, most people in the streets just don't know. You know what I mean? Like, so sometimes you can think these conversations are happening everywhere when they're really not.
Yeah, that's true. No, yeah, that's true. I definitely am not going to get in like a grudge match fighting over the female Ghostbusters. I did see it. It was interesting. It was I think Paul Feig directed it, the guy who did Freaks and Geeks, a show I really used to like a lot. Yeah,
I mean, like, and, I like Paul Feig, and I actually never got around to watching it. I have no opinion on it, but I'm not going to. Like, people got angry about it. We're just, unbelievable.
Not gonna fight about it or let it ruin your day. No, I know.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and even if you don't like it, I mean, like, the original Ghostbusters is still there, man. Just chill out.
I used to watch, because I was a kid in the 80s, I used to watch the Ghostbusters cartoon on Saturday morning. And I'm going to tell you, I think that is partly why I got into horror, too. Because in the 80s, the cartoons were pretty trippy and like a supernatural way. Like, I used to love A Pup Named Scooby-Doo, and I got the DVDs to my daughter to watch because we couldn't find it on anything, and she loves it. But they're so, like, you know, usually Scooby-Doo, there's not really, you know, there's a logical explanation like in the old ones, but these ones, there were sometimes, occasionally there was a little bit of supernatural stuff, and I'm like, that's awesome. And they just had like these random like break into these like Peanuts dances, like these kind of like Snoopy dances, and it was just so silly, but it was like them as kids, and there was something very freeing about it. But I used to love that, and the Ghostbusters, and even when I was a little older, I would watch like the Tales from the Crypt cartoon. I think it was Tales from the Crypt Keeper, and I do like Tales from the Crypt. I love anthology horror. Actually, I have a story I wrote coming out in an anthology horror video series that they do. They it's called The Grey Rooms. I don't know if you've heard of it. I'm not allowed to talk about it yet, but it's going to come out. They'll murder me, but like, no, I'm kidding. But like, it's going to come out, I believe, in 2022.
Well, this episode will come out in 2022. I mean, like, it's being recorded now in December. I always flag this up to the listeners when episodes are recorded and like when they're actually out in the world. But this probably won't be out in the world till like sometime in 2022. I'm thinking probably March.
Cool. Well, that's okay. So if it comes out before or whatever, perhaps they will serendipitously, you know, meet like at the intersection of whenever they both come out. But I mean, I'm not allowed to talk about it yet, but they're cool and I'm excited with what they're doing for sure. And yeah, it's called The Grey Rooms. And I love anthology horror. I grew up, like I said, Twilight Zone, Tales from the Crypt, Amazing Stories in the 80s. I don't know if you remember that one. I like any like I guess because I love short stories too, you know, so I love that kind of like condensed like horror, and especially with a narrator, like with the Crypt Keeper and everything. Or, you know, just like the idea, like they break, you know, the wall with reality, and then they talk, you know, straight at you. And or sometimes, you know, it's I love that.
It's I don't know, maybe it's just because like I talk to a lot of people of a similar age to me on the podcast, but it's fascinating to me. It seems like it was like a weird time in the kind of 80s and 90s. Where there was a lot of things, a lot of horror for kids, and a lot of cartoons that were like, there was a lot of cartoons that were kind of connected to like adult material that just doesn't happen now. Because I remember when I was a kid, like, and I was born in 1985, so like in the kind of the very early 90s. I remember there was all these cartoons that was like, there was like the Toxic Crusaders, which was like, you know, the cartoon version of the Toxic Avenger, and
yes,
you know, and things like, and even things like Conan and RoboCop and all this kind of stuff that's not like really, it's not horror, but like but is, you know, very kind of adult movies and stuff like that. And you know, and then yeah, things like Tales from the Crypt, and then I would go and watch the movies of Tales from the Crypt that came out and stuff like that. And you know, and it's just weird that there was so much kind of material for kids that was either connected to adult material, connected to horror material. And then there were shows like Are You Afraid of the Dark and The Goosebumps Show and stuff like that. There's just loads of stuff horror for kids in the 80s and 90s for some reason.
Oh yeah, like I said, I would read the R.L. Stine books when I was a kid, and I read the Fear Streets before I actually read Goosebumps. That was later, but it was like, because you know, I was in junior high school, and it was just like these enticing covers of like, you know, these like pretty girls looking like they're going to prom and like a killer in the background. And you know, and then I loved like watching like Prom Night with Jamie Lee Curtis. We used to rent movies from the video store. Me and my friends would rent the same movies over and over again. So heavily in our rotation was like Prom Night and like the Rocky Horror Picture Show and Rosemary's Baby. That was big into our rotation. I love The Exorcist.
Have you ever seen Prom Night 2?
No, I should though. Nah, I didn't. I have not. Was Jamie Lee in it?
No, Jamie Lee was not in it, and it's not connected to Prom Night at all.
Oh wow!
It's insane. It's a
look. I need to see this.
I can't. Yeah, it's called Prom Night 2. Hello, Mary Lou. And it's
Hello, Mary Lou.
Yes, which like a ghost of like a prom queen from the 50s like comes back to haunt high school in the 80s. It's insane, but wow. It and I can't necessarily recommend it as a good movie, but it is a great fun time.
Well, yeah, I love a fun movie like that. Like, oh yeah, like just, you know, anything that hits the right notes. Well, we were talking earlier about the trauma movies, and I mean, we'd all sit around. I remember in college. And me and like a bunch of punk rock kids, and we'd be like, oh, we're watching Romeo and Juliet, you know, and it was like the best times. But you know, just being able to connect with people, watching things that, you know, I don't know, we used to go to the independent video store, and me and my one roommate would like try to like outrank each other with weird movies. We ended up watching, I think one of our weirder ones was I don't know if you ever saw Peter Jackson's Meet the Feebles.
Yes, and
this came about because we went into the independent video store, and I said to the guy there, I was like, do you have any puppet porn? And he goes, puppet porn? And I'm like porn with puppets? He goes, I have something kind of like that. Have you seen Meet the Feebles? And I'm like, no. So we rented that, and we rented like Naked Lunch, when they had Slaughterhouse-Five has a movie.
I've never seen the movie version of that. I've read the book, but I've never
interesting
seen
how they edit it. Yeah. Oh, I love the book, Billy Pilgrim. Sometimes I really, you know, I feel with Billy Pilgrim, I mean, and I could be totally off base. Sometimes I just come up with these things, but I really think it had to be like a trauma response for him being in the war, Vonnegut, because it was like he was maybe dissociated. Just the idea of like he gets unstuck through time. I've had trauma myself, and I often feel like I'm kind of getting unstuck in time, like different events. And like, there were times I'd just wake up and be like, where am I? What time is it? You know, it's weird how anxiety and trauma kind of play into things, but I love that book. I thought it was so brilliant. You know, why me, why anybody? And then what did he say? He was always like, So it goes.
I think about that a lot. I suppose because, you know, when things, bad things, you know, things that are challenging, you know, happen, you know, I think it is actually a good life philosophy. You know, I think about that phrase a lot, and so it goes, you know, like.
Yeah. And it's sad and kind of comforting at the same time, you know, like, yeah. it's, my dad always says about, you know, death, the idea of it and everything. He's like, you know, I remember I used to be really scared of it when I was younger. And he said to me, you know, he's like, it's a trip we're all going to have to take. And that kind of comforted me in a way. It's like, we're not alone. You know, people have gone through a lot and people continue to go through a lot, but we can connect as human beings. We're not alone, you know? And I think especially now people, I get saddest when I hear about people having, you know, depression and not having anybody to reach out to or being embarrassed to reach out. And I think most people, like you said, I do believe most people are good and kind and want to connect and would help people. But there are people that are toxic or dangerous, and you hope for the best, but we have to protect ourselves, but also, you know, each other as human beings. And I know I went off on a rant there.
No, that's totally fine. We all have tangents on this podcast. I'm always going off on tangents. You know how you mentioned earlier that, you know, like, you put the exclamation points in your title because, like, that's, you know, that's how you talk. Like, if you read any of my film reviews, you'll notice that there's a bunch of things that are like side points written in brackets because I tend to talk like that. And some people see this as a weakness of my writing, but I continue to still write like that.
Oh, in brackets? No, I actually had a piece edited because I put too many brackets, which I understood at the time because it was confusing, but it was a piece about dark comedies. And I'm definitely not an editor. I can go off on tangents, but I love brackets. I get it. You're like, want to sidebar, tell me something. And you know, and I actually appreciate the brackets, but everybody's different. But
yeah, I think we're in the minority. I think like the majority do not like that. I think I've been told before, like, I'm also not an editor. So I try to, especially if I'm not writing on my own website, I try to sharpen up my reviewing a little bit.
I do. I try to say less. I have a tendency, even when I read, I like to read a lot of like I love like The Great Gatsby and like that flowery kind of prose that almost has that connection to poetry. But I have a tendency to try now. I try to say as much as I can say with less words, you know, which is, it depends. Like a lot of times when I write my stories, especially my short fiction, it's harder when I write something longer. But I have like these little black plain composition books. I'll date the story and I start writing and I write it in my script. And then when I'm editing it, I edit it, I type it into the computer. And then that also helps me edit as I go along. It's a weird process. And I wouldn't say it's for everyone, but it works well for me with fiction. I like having the handwriting in the notebook. It reminds me of just when I first started writing and writing in diaries. And it just connects me. But I also like to be able to type, and I use the typing as an opportunity to edit it. So that always becomes my second draft. And I found with writing it, people just have their own like little quirks. It's almost like when people go play bingo at a bingo parlor or something, and they bring the little troll dolls and their little like good luck talismans and things. And it's like that in a way. Like, you know, I'll use this. I like to write with black pens. I like to write it in cursive that I can read it and look back on it. And I date what I write, and then I date when I return to write it. And, you know, I don't know. I just noticed we all have our things that kind of, you know, keep us kind of centered with it. I noticed that about writers. Maybe it's like athletes too. Don't they have their certain rituals they do before games and things like that? So
yeah, I don't know. I remember like, a lot of athletes have like different different things that they do as kind of pre-match rituals or whatever. I remember reading about the tennis player Rafa Nadal, and I think I can't remember exactly what he does. I think he like ties his shoelaces in a certain way or something, something like that. And I might be getting that slightly wrong, but he definitely has like a kind of ritual that he does like before matches and stuff like that. And yeah, I mean, like athletes are often quite superstitious.
Yeah. I think whatever works for a person. I was reading this book, I think it was Claude Bristol wrote it. It's called The Magic of Believing. It's very trippy. And how I even found out about this book was, I think Phyllis Diller like swore by it, and she used to talk about it in interviews. And it was basically like the predecessor of like, you know, the Napoleon Hill kind of books, or like The Secret, you know, and they always kind of regurgitate and make a book like that. And, you know, just for different, you know, kind of new agey stuff. But it was basically like visualizing what you want as your goals, and they manifest, you know, and like write what you want. Like he was saying something about like, if you were going to doodle, if your dream is to make a lot of money, draw dollar signs all day. And at some point, it just your subconscious kind of like responds, or like put on your dream on like a little note card and tape little note cards around. So even when you're not paying attention, you actually are paying attention to this, like the thing that you want. Like if you want to be, you know, I want to be a famous writer or something, if that was the dream, you know, then you put it somewhere all around, and at some point it kind of starts manifesting. It was really good, kind of trippy new agey stuff, but I like to read a lot of like pseudosciencey books and paranormal kind of, you know, books. So, but it was just interesting. But The Magic of Believing, apparently Phyllis Diller and a bunch of other comedians were just really like back then, like they just like, that was her book. And she said that that made her a career at the time. So I thought that was kind of fascinating.
It is weird like that, you know, like I, because like a lot of that, like I kind of ignore or kind of be like, the kind of magical thinking or whatever, but it can lead to like create a road of ruin, but like also at the same time, it clearly works for some people. Because I always remember like an interview I saw with Jim Carrey, where he was like, when he was a child, he wrote himself a check. $20 million,
yeah.
And he'd always look at the check for $20 million, and then, you know, like he got $20 million for a film. I think it's when he made, I can't remember what movie he made in the 90s, but like it was either The Mask or Batman Forever or something like that, you know. He got $20 million for, you know, can't discredit it totally, I suppose.
But it's interesting because it's almost like some people, I think, do have that sense of their destiny. Like I know you're also a big rock and metal fan as well, and like I was reading about, I think, like, Jerry Cantrell, like, used to, when they had, he had one of those little books, like, What I Want to Be When I Grow Up, and he wrote in it, rock star, like, when he was a child, and, he, you know, and I think Lane Staley knew he wanted to be a singer. I know his mother was a singer, but he knew, like, from a very young age. And, I mean, I always felt that way about writing. Not to say that I ever thought I would be, like, some famous writer or something. No, I just wanted to write and connect with people, and I am doing exactly what I want to do. I'm who I always was. It's funny. They have these little blurbs we had to write when I was in. My teacher used to laminate these stories that we wrote. And I actually wrote a little ghost story and a little story about a girl moving away when we were moving, and little things. And she laminated it. And it had my little author bio on the back. And it was like, Christina Delia, you know. She loved, her favorite show is Full House, which obviously it's not now. But I guess when I was, you know, 6 years old or whatever, 7 years old. Actually, I was probably 8 because I didn't really learn how to read and write. It didn't all connect for me until I was about 8 years old. That's when it really connected. And I was a late bloomer and I wanted it so bad. I wanted to write. I wanted to read. All these kids did it so easily and I wanted it. And then it was funny because when I finally could write and read, they all kind of took it for granted and I just became immersed in it. But in the little bio, it said, like, Christina Delia, you know, wants to be a writer. Her favorite food is pizza, which it still is. Yeah, and I just, I'm the same person I always was in that respect, but so much growth through life, and yes, the pain we carry, but to channel it into writing is kind of the writer's mission, I think, and it is therapeutic, and so anybody, I think, who would be starting out with writing or wondering, oh, I feel like I have a book in me, but I'm scared, like, I would say just get a little notebook and put the pen to paper, just start writing a few lines a day, and astound yourself. And I am a magical thinker still. I mean, I was, that kind of got me through a lot of bad stuff as a kid. And I think it's okay to kind of have that balance. I mean, you know, ground yourself in enough reality. You know, you have to do the work. I can't sit here and doodle and then assume that I'm going to become a writer just because I drew little like pencils all over a piece of paper. I don't care what Claude Bristol says, but more to it, like really live and breathe it and read and connect. And yeah, but anybody who dreams of writing, I think should go for it because it is so satisfying. And it is really, it's free therapy because you are in touch with yourself and you're healing yourself in ways that, you know, the outside world, they can help you for sure, but it's coming from you. It's, you're evolving and you actually have tangible proof of that on your pages. You know, your stories evolve, your visions, your perspective, you know? So I just love writing. And I know a lot of people get self-conscious about it and they're like, oh, I can't write. You can write. I'm like, you can write, you know, you get better at, I mean, I can't play the piano, but I venture to say that if I start taking lessons and play a little bit, I could get a little better, you know, like, so I never tell people they can't write. I encourage it. And that's why I love writers' workshops. And I, one day, hopefully maybe I'll be able to teach one. I just think they're just amazing. I love creativity and I love nurturing it.
I think that's a beautiful note to end the interview on. You know, motivating any aspiring writers out there. So is there any kind of last things that we've maybe not talked about that you would like to promote before we wrap up this interview?
I'm just thinking about my most recent, let's see. Well, like I said, Unburied, a collection of queer dark fiction edited by Rebecca Rowland. I actually bought both. I bought the hardcover and the paperback because I love, it's the most gorgeous hardcover. They put out a beautiful book, I will say, Dark Ink Press. And they do a lot of cool books. If you ever just check out, like, they do like biographies of horror actors. And they did one about the lady who played Pazuzu, the actress who played Pazuzu in The Exorcist. They just have the coolest books. Like, I know it's Christmas, like, people should check them out, Dark Ink, because they got some cool stuff. And I was in a book recently. It was a Ramones tribute. It was from Fahrenheit Press. I had a story and it was originally, the story that we made the title was, I Don't Want to Go Down to the Basement. So we all picked a Ramones song, and the book was Gabba Gabba Hey, Ramones Tribute, Fahrenheit Press, and they're real cool. Planet Scum, issue 12, Skeletaxonomy, that's the name of it. If you just check out the cover, that art, I mean, Planet Scum, they know how to do it, really. It's so cool. Like, I mean, like I said, I loved The Twilight Zone. I loved, you know, I'm not super sci-fi, but I like enough, like, punk rock kind of sci-fi, and they hit all those notes. Like, they're awesome. And my book I'm going to be putting out soon, if people are interested in my kind of dark poetry, it'll be from KDP, and you know, it'll be Guts, Lips, 55 Voracious Poems. And it's really me, if you're curious. It's, you know, if I was gonna die tomorrow and I put a book out, you know, I'm a happy girl. I gotta get this book out because that's where I'm at and it's where I came from. And it's got that punk rock aesthetic to me. I was a 90s kid. Just the idea of, like, just the zines, you know, that kind of culture. And I guess that's also with the exclamation parts of the exclamation marks, the urgency, look at this, this is what I have to say. And also, to be honest with you, it's very feminist because the guts is my physical guts, and it's also my, you know, emotional guts, my mentality. And the lips is, you know, my mouth, that, you know, I've been called a motor mouth, I keep talking, but also, you know, my vagina. I'm a woman, I'm proud to be myself, and we all should be proud to be who we are. And the Grey Room's coming out in the fall. Check them out because they're really cool, dark, atmospheric, and I'm so excited with what they're doing, but I'm not allowed to talk about it, but it'll be cool. So thank you so much for having me. This has been so much fun.
Excellent. Thank you very much for being on the show, and please be sure to come back again.
Yes, absolutely. Have a great holiday, and it's just been delightful talking to you. I feel like we're friends, and you may call me Chris, absolutely.
That was my guest Christina there, who I'd like to thank once again for coming on the show. Also, as always, I'd like to thank you, listener, for tuning in to this latest episode of New Horror Express. Remember, if you like what you heard, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify. And if you can make any of those reviews 5 stars, that would be great.
as otherwise the algorithm thinks we're shit. For reasons beyond my know, but that's how it is. 5 stars. Anyway, that's all for this time, but be sure to tune in next time when I will have another great guest from the world of indie horror. Until then, though, see ya.